Well, amen. It's good to see you tonight. We're going to jump right in as we have been pressed for time, and I am serious about trying to give you opportunities for questions, so we're just going to jump right in. We've been talking over the last several weeks about how God has revealed himself to man. And we talked about revelation in creation, a general revelation, revelation throughout salvation history. Then we got into specific revelation where God, through his Son and through now for us, his Word has revealed himself to us. So tonight, we're going to begin to investigate what it is that God actually has revealed. But we need to realize from the beginning this sort of caveat, this sort of umbrella that helps us as we will begin to walk through the next several weeks about what God has revealed in his Word, and that is that God does not reveal all that we want him to reveal or think that he should reveal. Many times we come to the Bible and we ask, why didn't God tell us this, or why didn't he show us that, or why didn't he explain this better, or whatever. God is not obligated to reveal every single detail about every single thing. He couldn't put it in a book for us to understand it anyway. It'd be like 6 bazillion books, right? When you think about all the things that, all the truth that we're discovering, even that through his grace that he's allowing us to discover with new inventions and things like that. If God just gave us every single thing, then we couldn't contain it anyway. So oftentimes we ask, why didn't God reveal this or that? But what we need to realize is that we don't need to concern ourselves with what God left out, but we need to concern ourselves with what he gave us, what he did reveal to us. That's what's important. God does not answer every question that you and I might have. However, he does answer all of the questions that you and I need answered. And that is important. What God did reveal to us are those things that we need answered in our lives. The important things. So if he revealed it, then that means it's important. Therefore, that's what we should be concerning ourselves with, not chasing and spending all our time trying to figure out all the things that he didn't reveal to us. So he gives us the answers to the most important questions. And the truths that he gives us, what he reveals to us, show us who he is and how we are to relate to him. Now think about it. Remember we talked in 2 Peter before. We've been given everything for life and godliness. God has given us everything we need to live this life and to live it in a godly manner. He has revealed who he is, and he has revealed how we are to relate to him. And that is the most important thing that you can know and that you can have in life. Who God is and how you can relate to him, how you can have a relationship with him. So what is it that God tells us about himself? Well, the first thing is that God, what we see is that God is God apart from any outside power or influence. In other words, God is self-sufficient. That's what we're going to talk about tonight, the self-sufficiency of God. He exists as God and has always existed as God, without the necessity of anyone or anything else. Now think about that. He is God, and he is God and always has been God without the need of any other outside influence, outside power, outside anything. He's self-contained. He's self-dependent. He's self-sufficient. God is God, and he always has been God, and he always will be God, and he doesn't need anything else to be God, and he never needed anything else to become God. Okay, he always has been God as he is. And we see this in the first 3 words of the Bible. It reveals that to us, really. And it says, in the beginning, God. Now, I can count. I realize that's 4 words. All right. In the Hebrew, it's 3 words. It's literally, in beginning, God. I don't want to chase a rabbit, but basically when it says in beginning, if it doesn't have the article, basically what it's saying is, it wasn't there was this beginning somewhere out there that God then came into existence. No. Beginning happened when God spoke time into existence. All right? So in beginning, God. Now, that's the important part. Notice that the Bible doesn't argue for God. It doesn't try to defend or give argument as to why there is a God. It doesn't give us all of these different apologetics that you know there's a God because of this before it starts to tell us about God. The Bible just assumes God. He is. He always has been. So the first thing that God reveals to us in the first three words is that God, He is in existence. He always has been in existence before anything and without anything. So it states also that He acted without permission or power or insight from any other being. In beginning, God created. In beginning, God, He did. He acted. He did what He wanted to do. He did what was in accordance with His character, and He did it within His own power without the need of any outside influence. He created. He literally spoke everything into existence. So He is self-sufficient. God, He existed and He acted. He is and He does. God always possesses everything needed for being who He is and for doing all that He does. Which means God created, we talked about this Sunday, God created, He used His power, His wisdom, and then on the seventh day He rested. But He didn't rest because He lost some power or because He lost some wisdom or He needed to recharge. He rested because everything that He wanted to do, He did, and it was good, and it was perfect, and it was complete, and so He rested. And so it isn't as though God acts and now He's lost something. He is as much God today and was much God on the seventh day and had as much power and as much wisdom as He did before time ever began. Now, I know that's hard for us to start to get our minds around, but that's the point. That's why I'm going to just hammer this and hammer this tonight. He is self-sufficient. He doesn't need us. Let that sink in. He doesn't need any other being in order to be God or to act as He desires. He doesn't need any other source for His power. He doesn't need any other source for His wisdom. And God is the only being that is like that. By definition, it has to be that way. Everything and everyone else is not self-sufficient, but are fully dependent upon outside sources for their existence and for their ability to act. Think about this in your life. Think about all the things that you depend on in order to exist. Nobody is self-sufficient. Okay, that is a characteristic of God that sets Him apart, His self-sufficiency. You are fully dependent upon a whole lot of things. And you say, well, wait a minute, I can go and I can hunt and I can, you know, do all this stuff. Well, somebody had to make the bullets and somebody had, well, I can build my own bullet and I can build my own gun and I can do all this stuff, all right? Well, somebody had to make the tools in order for you to build your own stuff. Well, I can make the tools. Well, somebody had to make the iron and the ore and the water. Okay, I mean, you just trace this back. Not to mention when you were born, if somebody would have left you on your own and not fed you and not taken care of you, you would no longer exist. So you are not self-sufficient. Only God is self-sufficient. He is not dependent on anything. If He needed anything in order to be complete, in order to exist, in order to be full, then by definition, He is no longer God. If He is not self-sufficient, if this being that is revealed in the Bible that we worship, that we give our lives over to, if He is not self-sufficient, He is no longer God. He isn't the God that we should be worshiping. By definition, God must be self-sufficient. You can neither add to God nor subtract from God. You cannot give Him anything He does not have. You cannot tell Him anything He does not know. All truth, all wisdom, all power, all understanding, all kindness, all love, every good quality is contained within God's own life as God. So everything that you see revealed about God always was, and it always will be, it always has been, and it always will be, in the eons of time, as far as you can make your mind press back It has been, and in the eons of times into eternity, as far as you can press your mind, he always will be and will have those characteristics. Never losing anything, never gaining anything. He is God. And that is the foundation for everything else. Because he doesn't need us, but it speaks also to his grace, which we will get to. All right. And this is why, over and over, I keep telling you that the greatest act of a loving God is to reveal himself to man. Now think about that. If every good quality, his kindness, if he is all truth, all wisdom, he's all power, all understanding, he is all love, all kindness, all grace, patience, peace, all of those things, all of those are contained in him, then the most unloving thing he could do would be to create someone and say, I'm not going to allow you to know me. But yet God has revealed himself, and he is self-sufficient, and he has all of those things, and the most loving thing he could do is say, listen, I want you to know me. Now, I know you think that the greatest act of a loving God would be to give you unlimited ice cream sprinkles for the rest of your life. Okay, follow the metaphor there, right? Whatever I want. If he would just make my life easier, then that's the most loving thing. If he would just heal me of this sickness, then that's the most loving thing. If he would just. And the reason we think that way is because we want to define God on our terms. That's our nature. We exchange the glory of God for the creature. We want to begin to define what God should be and how he should act. God doesn't need you to define who he is or how he should act. He is. Therefore, he acts because of who he is. And so when he acts, you can know that he is acting out of his character. And when he revealed himself, he's saying, I want you to know the most loving, the most kind, the most gracious, all-powerful, all-knowing being that there is. I am allowing you to know me. It was the most loving act that he could do. If God is within himself, then all that is good and glorious, then the most loving thing he could do is to reveal supreme love and glory to you and to me, which is to reveal himself to us. Now, look, this isn't contrary to the cross being God's primary demonstration of love, but it fits perfectly with it. So I keep saying the most loving act God could do is to reveal himself, but what does the Bible say? God demonstrated his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, right? No, it fits perfectly with it. Christ was God revealing himself to us. That's who Christ was. God in the flesh. And Christ on the cross was God revealing his supreme love to us. So in that very act, he is saying, I want you to know me, but not just know me. I want you to be able to know me. So they fit together. He's just doing it in a different way, and he's doing it in a greater way, but it's the same thing. He's revealing himself and he is showing you how you can relate to him. Acts chapter 17, verse 24. Paul is in Athens. He's preaching the gospel, and the new teaching of Christ crucified and resurrected attracts the attention of the philosophers in Athens. And so they invite Paul to come to the Areopagus. And that's just was a large facility in Athens where these philosophers would go and they would listen to each other. They would discuss different philosophies of life. So Paul steps up and he begins to share the gospel with them. And he says, you need to know, because they're listening and they're hearing about Christ crucified and Christ resurrected, and they're saying, this is a strange teaching. We want you to teach us. And so Paul steps into the Areopagus. Now listen to what he starts with, though. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Paul starts with God and who he is and his self-sufficiency. Because these are philosophers. They're not Jews. They don't have an understanding already of who the God of the Bible is. And so that's where he starts. You start with the foundation of God and who he is, because then everything else fits within that. And so Paul says, it is God and God alone that is the giver of not just life, but everything to man. He gives everything to man. And he uses this as an argument to elevate God to his rightful position above all the other false idols that were in Athens. In this Areopagus, they had all of these idols to different gods. Man, they were everything. And Paul goes by and he sees they had built an idol to the unknown God. And he used that as the opportunity to get in. And he said, listen, this unknown God that you're talking about, let me tell you who he is. He's unlike all the other gods. He is self-sufficient. He doesn't need anything from man. He's the one that gives everything, everything, life and breath and everything to man. God did not need anything from man, as evidenced by the fact that he could not be contained in buildings. He was not in need of man's help. And it was God who gave man everything that man has, not the least of which is life and breath. And so Paul just goes down and he says, this is the God. He isn't contained in buildings. He doesn't need anything from you. And by the way, everything that you have, you received from him. He's self-sufficient. He does not need you. That's the God that I'm fixing to tell you about, Paul says. If all you have, all that you have has been given to you, then what can you give to the one who gave it to you? Nothing, because he has it all already. A self-sufficient being is not dependent upon the beings that he created and the beings that he sustains. In a second, God snaps his fingers. God thinks a thought, and you no longer exist. Another verse that makes his self-sufficiency very clear is James chapter 1, verse 7. James says, do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Now, it's interesting, leave that up there, that James starts this truth about God with a warning against deception. Don't be deceived. So then, what follows then counters a false teaching or a false belief. And he says that every good and perfect gift that you receive comes from God. So what does this mean? Well, first it means everything good that you have, God gave it to you. Everything good that you have, God gave it to you. It didn't come because of luck. It didn't come because of chance. And it didn't come to you because of your hard work. Now, your hard work may be the means by which God gave you what he gave you, but be sure that God is the one that gave it. And that's why you have it. Second, it means this. It means every gift God gives is good. Not only does every good thing that you have come from God, but everything that God gives you, everything that you receive from God is good. He does not give anything that isn't good, because he gives out of his character. Therefore, everything you receive from God is a good gift. So listen, the next time you start thinking that your wife is not the best that you can do, you remember that she's God's gift to you. Therefore, she is good. Whenever you start complaining about the things that you have and wishing that you have more and longing for better, remember God gave you everything that he gave you, and it is good. And you're looking at your children and you wish they were more like the Joneses' child. God gave you those children. They are a gift from him, and so therefore they are good. Doesn't mean they're good kids. It means they're good, all right? They're wicked to the core, all right? But they're a good gift from God. Love them. Third, it means God cannot give what he doesn't already have, and that's where we get into the self-sufficiency. He gives, we receive. He needs nothing from us, and we receive all things from him. And God can give us all things because of the greatness of his resources. Look at Isaiah chapter 40, verse 12, as we wrap this up. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span? Enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? And of course, the answer is nobody. And Isaiah here is using what we call anthropomorphism. And basically, that just means he's ascribing human attributes to God. He talks about his hand and he talks about his mind. But we know that God is a spirit being. He cannot be contained. And so you might think at first that this is contrary to what Isaiah is trying to accomplish. If he's talking about the greatness of God, why does he begin to limit him with these characteristics of man, with hand and all of these things? Because it's the only way that we can even begin to understand just the tip of the iceberg of who God is. Describing himself through human attributes is God's grace to finite beings. When we begin to think about the hand that holds the world or the hand that has the universe, we begin to see with better picture the grandness and the greatness of God. And so it's God's grace as he writes this and reveals himself to us and he says, listen, my hand holds everything. And then you begin to back up from there and you think about then his arm and his shoulders as they wrap themselves around you in time of need, as they provide for you. Isaiah is describing in these verses the greatness and the grandness of God. And with these questions, he is challenging us to reevaluate ourselves in light of the infinite power and the self-sufficiency of God. His grandness leads to our ungrandness. It should humble us. It should cause us to bow down and worship. So what is the application here, real quick? Number one, God's self-sufficiency means he doesn't need you and he doesn't need others to accomplish his will. Now, I know this is going to bruise you a little, but God can get along just fine without you and without me. What it does, or what it should do, is encourage you because it points to the grace of God that he would choose to use you. He doesn't need you, but he chooses to use you anyway. He doesn't have to have a relationship with you, but he chooses to do so anyway. Think about it. He doesn't need you because he's self-sufficient. And using you, quite frankly, probably means a bigger headache. What if I gave you an assignment and your assignment was to set up 300 dominoes so that they all topple down in whatever pattern you created? 300 dominoes. Except you have to use a 3-year-old. God doesn't need us. But he's gracious despite our rebellion, gracious despite our inabilities, gracious despite our lack of wisdom, and our running off doing things and knocking the dominoes over and him telling us how to set them up and us ignoring him. He still says, but I want to use you. And he pursues us. And by his grace, he transforms us and he matures us to be usable. He includes you in his plans. He uses you to accomplish his plans despite your frailties and weaknesses. He invites you to be a part of what he is doing, but he doesn't need you in order to do it. Nor does he need others. He doesn't need the cooperation of the House and the Senate in order to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Praise God. So stop getting so uptight about the government's decisions. The failure of the government does not mean the failure of God's will. He is going to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be involved in government or strive to put godly men in office. But what it means is you can rest in his sufficiency, knowing that God is going to move all things in the direction he desires, whether kings and princes and presidents or in-laws or co-workers or bosses agree or not. He does not need them either. He will accomplish his will. All right, number two. His greatness demands our worship. Only a self-sufficient, good-giving God is deserving of your awe and adoration, your obedience, your full-fledged surrender. Quit chasing after other things that need you or that need something else. They're false gods. Rest and go after and give your life to the one who is self-sufficient, who invites you into relationship with him. It is because he doesn't need anything that we give him our praise and adoration. The fact that he does not need our worship is exactly the reason that he is deserving of it. The fact that he needs nothing from me, not even my worship, is the reason that I worship him. His grandness, his gloriousness in all of his character, in all of who he is. Number three. All that God has given you is good because it comes from God, who is inherently good. Therefore, he gives you and he gives you and he pours his grace out on you. Therefore, what he has allowed or not allowed is good for you. Man, there is so much freedom in the sufficiency of God and in the fact that he gives us out of his sufficiency good gifts. It means that job that you just thought was it and was going to, you know, save your life and everything was going to fall into place and you didn't get it, that's good. Because God didn't allow it. He has another plan and his plan is better than your plan. So you don't have to stress. Or the job that you lose, you don't have to stress. Or whatever it is that you think is going to make your life complete that you don't get, God is showing you that you don't need that for your life to be complete, that he is what you need for your life to be complete. Everything that he gives you, everything that he doesn't give you, it's all good because every gift is good. It also means this, that his commands are good. The commands of God are not to weigh you down. They're not to make your life miserable. The commands of God, the instruction of God, God's word, all that he reveals and all that he tells you to do, they're good for you. They are good in your life. Tithing and giving sacrificially is good. Marriage until death do you part is good. Marriage between a man and a woman is good. And so therefore we should protect marriage between a man and a woman. God created it that way, therefore it is good. It means the body that you have been given is good. Ladies, listen to me. Stop looking in the mirror and trying to figure out what's wrong. God gave you that face. He gave you those features. He gave you that body. He gave you that shape. He gave you your hair. He gave you the eyebrows that keep trying to grow together. He gave you that stuff. It's good. Your body is good. Men. Well, we don't usually care, but anyway, it's good. It's good. All right? All right. And then lastly, listen, just for context, especially where we are today, different sexes are good. God created man and woman, and he created them with different anatomy, and it is good. And therefore, we should not cave in to what the world wants to say is better. Now listen, I'm going to take half a second here, all right, just to say something. If you live in Kingwood or you live in Humble or you live wherever it is that you live so that you can vote this coming November in Houston, and I don't know where that line is or whatever, you need to be registered and you need to vote. And you need to vote against Proposition 1. Which is the proposition that allows a man who wakes up one morning and decides, today I want to be a woman, to go into a bathroom. There's no test. There's no nothing. He can announce that he wants to be a woman. He can walk into a woman's bathroom, and he can use that facility. This is that whole thing where the mayor pushed it through, and we have fought it, and we finally got it on the ballot. Now listen to me. Do you know what the percentage of people in Houston that showed up to vote last year? Anybody know? 9 to 10%. You know what that means? That means, listen, literally it means 100,000 votes against Prop 1 will defeat it because so few people show up to vote. Listen, we have a responsibility as Christians to protect what is good and to fight for what is good and to stand up for what is good. And God has given us this gift as good. And if you can vote, then you need to vote, and you need to vote no on Prop 1. Now listen, all of these things, some of these things that God tells us we don't understand, but here's what you need to know. You don't have to see how or why what God commands is good. All you have to know is that they are from God, and therefore they are good, and therefore that's what we're going to support. That's what we're going to go after. That's what we're going to have in our lives. It's what God wants. Why? Because I need God, and I certainly do need God, and He doesn't need you. So He doesn't need us trying to look at His Word, what's very plain, and try to tell Him what actually should be happening and what's better. No, we need Him. He doesn't need us.